This is an ABC podcast.
What's going on right now can feel so important. I mean, that's especially true now in the time of global pandemic. But whatever it is that's going on, our own moment in history tends to throw everything else into the shade. But what about if we widen our perspective to 100 years ago, or 1,000, or even right back to 100 million years ago, which is where our story today begins. In the last of our From the Festivals episodes, it's my conversation with the scientist Tim Flannery. And with Tim, we're travelling back in time to discover a Europe where rhinos and elephants roamed along tropical beaches, and humans and Neanderthals made new hybrid babies together. This is the surprising picture of Europe found in Tim's book, Europe and Natural History. I spoke with Tim Flannery at last year's Byron Writers Festival. Tim, if I picture the map of Europe in my head, you know, the shape of its landmass with the boot of Italy at the bottom and the British Isles up on the top left, how does that compare with the shape I'd see if I could travel back 100 million years?
Well, Europe was would have occupied the same sort of place in terms of latitude and longitude, pretty much. But the landmass was a very different shape in the past. So for most of Europe's history, Europe has been an island archipelago that was probably more similar to Vanuatu today than the Europe that we know presently. And that is such an important thing to understand, that Europe has been this island archipelago that has really acted as the crossroads of the world. So by virtue of where it is on the map, it's intermittently linked the three greatest land masses that exist on our planet. So Asia, Africa and North America have all been linked with that island archipelago through time, and that's allowed migration of species from Asia into Europe and from Europe into North America or into Africa or out of Africa. It's been this perpetual exchange, and that's what has really made Europe and what characterises it as being very different from every other continent.
Which part of Europe has the richest fossil record from right back 100 million years ago? Where do we need to go for that?
For me, the most exciting and interesting and deep record is in Romania, believe it or not. And Romania is this, we think of it as being peripheral to Europe in some ways today, but it really is central to the story of Europe over the long term.
Were dinosaurs the top of the food chain back in this area that we now know as Romania 100 million years or so ago?
Well, surprisingly, no. It's interesting because Romania was then a series of islands. One of them, the best known, was a place called Harteg, which is now part of Transylvania.
Harteg, it sounds like something out of J.R. Tolkien. Who comes
does.
Up with these names?
It's the name of a village or a town. And the paleontologist who discovered this amazing history lived near Harteg. So that name has been given to this ancient island as well. And, you can imagine, think about islands today like New Zealand, right? It's a home for ancient and rather unusual animals, you know. And islands have been like that throughout history. And so on the island of Harteg, there was dinosaurs whose ancestors had got there across the oceans millions of years earlier, and other creatures that became really the first distinctively European organisms. And those dinosaurs adapted to that island life. So they became small, they dwarfed, and they remained kind of primitive. They didn't evolve as rapidly as the dinosaurs on the other continents. So the man who discovered this amazing fauna, Franz Noska, he said, well, Europe, you know, many years ago was the home of degenerate and dwarfish dinosaurs. Now, he was working during the age of empire, right? This was kind of when Europe was great. Every other nation and every other paleontologist was trying to find the biggest and best dinosaur, right, for their land, right? So the British dinosaur is better than the German one and so forth. So Nopska, he was so out of touch with all of that no one really took any notice of his work. And yet he was the guy who was proved to be right.
Tell me about, if it wasn't dinosaurs that were these impressive big animals at the top, what kind of creatures were roaming about eating and picking off these dinosaurs?
Indeed, what was eating the degenerate and dwarfish dinosaurs as well? That is a story in itself, and one that has only recently been uncovered. So Nopska was working in the 19th century, early 20th. This amazing organism that was the top predator on these islands was only discovered in 2000, and it is a gigantic pterosaur. I don't know whether you know pterosaurs. They're flying reptiles, kind of bat-like wings, enormous beaks. This thing was the size of a giraffe, right? It was, its head would have been way up above us. It had a beak that was 3 meters long, and these enormous wings that it would wrap around its body as it crawled about the place, you know.
So it crawled rather than flew often?
Yes, seems to have. It's so enormous, it's hard to imagine it flying. But maybe the young ones flew, getting from island to island, and then the older ones just got too big to fly. We don't know as yet. But, you know, I would have loved it if Nopska could have seen this thing, because Nopska was a Transylvanian count, right? He was writing it about the time that Dracula was being written by Bram Stoker, you know, and this Dracula-like creature.
They do sound like proto-Nosferatus.
Yeah.
Well, tell me more about Franz. So he was a count, a Transylvanian count. How did he first get interested in the ancient world?
Well, he lived on an estate, his own estate. I've been out to see his ruined mansion, the castle that he lived in. But his first engagement seems to be through his sister, Ilona, who was walking along a river on the family estate, found some bones, brought them back and showed them to her brother. He was just about to go to university, and he took the bones with him. And they turned out to be the bones of a dwarfish and degenerate dinosaur. You know, this was but Nopska was just really one out of the one in a billion. Really, he was this absolute eccentric. So he was the first man, for example, to section dinosaur bones, so to cut a thin section through them and study the growth rings. It was so far ahead of his time in doing that sort of stuff. So he could tell us how old that dinosaur was, how it had lived, and so forth. He invented his own glue to hold the bones together, you know. But beyond that, he was totally, he seemed not to care about society. He was incredibly rude to the other scientists around him, constantly trumpeting his own greatness. He was openly gay.
And this is what, 19th century?
This is 1895 or thereabouts, and madly in love with Albania. He became not only one of the world's great experts on dinosaurs, but the world's authority on Albanian culture. And his lover was a shepherd from the Accursed Mountains in Albania.
Is that a real place?
She really is, yes. Bazajid came from there. He seems to have had a series of lovers, Albanian shepherd lovers, but we won't go there at the moment. But Bazajid was sort of
the moment. Follow-up book to Europe is really going to focus on this area.
But it gets stranger and stranger, though, because he became this great authority on Albania. He fought in blood feuds and things in Albania. He wore the costume of a Skiptar warrior from the Albanian mountains. He finally, as Albania was starting to free itself from the Ottoman Empire, put himself forward as the king of Albania. And he said, I will lead an army of 500 men. He said, I've already paid for the men. I've got the steamship. All I need is some horses to help.
And how did that suggestion go down with the powers that be?
It didn't go down very well, because the Germans wanted to put Prince Willie of Weed in place, apparently, who lasted about 3 months. He was hopeless. But Nopska could have done the job, but unfortunately, he wasn't accepted. The British Foreign Office didn't like the idea of an gay Albanian count being the king of Albania. So that collapsed, and that was the beginning of a slow decline for Nopska. He lost his estates after the war. His serfs beat him up. He was made director of this splendid museum in Bucharest. You wouldn't believe the Geology Museum in Bucharest. If you ever get a chance to go to Romania, my first stop would be the Geology Museum in Bucharest. It is the most stunningly beautiful jewel box of a museum. So Nopska was made director of that. He was hopeless, he was too far ahead of his time to run those sort of things. So he decided to take Bazajid on his motorbike around Europe, where he visited noble, superannuated noblemen who'd lost their lands and lived off them. He sold his collection of dinosaurs. And finally, in 1935, in Vienna, he made Bazajid a cup of tea, gave it to him. It was laced with poison sleeping powders. Bazajid fell asleep. He dressed himself in his best motorcycle leathers, put a gun to his head, shot himself, left a lovely note to the police saying, don't allow any Hungarian scientists to mourn for me. They are all ratbags who've never supported me. And I want a Viking funeral, be burned in my leathers. Which he was an absolute one-off.
This isn't representative of paleontologists in general. This is a unique character.
Well, he was so unusual. I mean, he felt his vigour failing him as well, he underwent a rather odd operation called Steinacherization. Have you
Do
heard
tell
about
me.
This? It's the radical removal of a single vas deferens. was produced by, there was a kind of Austrian doctor who did these sort of things, and Nopcsa claimed to have been greatly invigorated by it. But, who knows what the truth is?
I'm sure there's somewhere in the back hills of Byron he'll remove a vasdeferrin for you if you ask.
Probably is. But I wouldn't undergo it. I'm honestly not.
So apart from being a wonderful character to know about, he had this insight into aging dinosaur bones. Yeah. Did he have a sense of the geography of ancient Europe as well?
Well, he did. He realised that Europe was... He was the first one to realise Europe was an island archipelago through most of its history. And he understood the implications.
How would he have picked that up? How would he have realised that?
Well, he was studying these dinosaurs. He understood that they must have been that way for a reason, and he knew enough of the science of zoogeography, which was then being developed by people like Alfred Russel Wallace and others, to understand the implications of that. And he could see elsewhere in Romania there was these remnants of marine environments, so ocean. They have this incredible thing in Romania called snail hills, which are these mountains made of the fossilised remains of marine snails. And you see them, they're just unbelievable. They're so interesting. And those, so he knew about those, and He just surmised that this was the case, that Europe was an ancient island archipelago. Was not believed for decades. In fact, his name was totally forgotten for a century, pretty much, just recently coming back. But he also did one other thing. He named the largest lizard which ever lived on our planet. It was Australian. The Aboriginal people would have seen it. It was a thing called Megalania, a gigantic goanna. Its fossils have been found in all parts of Australia. It was Nopcsa that named that. He had a penchant for reptiles and strange creatures.
In terms of naming and scientific names, what was the first name that was given to a dinosaur fossil, Tim?
Well, this is another part of European history that I find so interesting, because the science of paleontology started in Europe in a very unusual way. So the first dinosaur bone discovered and described was described by the Reverend Robert Plott, who was a professor at Oxford. He wrote the first natural history, really, modern natural history after Pliny, and it was called the Natural History of Oxfordshire. And in it, he illustrated this bone. So it's the end of a femur bone of a dinosaur. You know, there's two big condyles and the shaft and so forth. And he speculated on what it might be. He thought maybe it's the bone of an elephant that was brought here by the Romans. And then he went through the literature of ancient Rome and realised that elephants never got any closer than Marseille to Oxfordshire. So that idea was out. And finally, in desperation, he said, well, maybe it's the bone of a giant. I don't know. And about a century later, another researcher took his illustration and said, well, it is from a giant, but it's not a bone at all. It's a scrotum, he says. The big two big things are the balls. And the reason this idea came to him was that in those days, everyone believed that Geoffrey of Monmouth's history of Britain, British kings, was true. And Geoffrey of Monmouth starts his story with the sack of Troy. And Aeneas' son, Brutus, leaves the sacked city, comes to Britain, marries one of the giants of Albion, right? So this was believed to be true. I guess in those days, doubting the king's lineage was a dangerous thing to do, but everyone believed it. So he said, oh, maybe these are the testicles that begat the queen, the first queen of England kind of thing, preserved miraculously. And this idea was so enthusiastically taken up that a very eminent French philosopher managed to make out the vas deferens and the urethra in this. It was kind of considered a wonder in its day.
I'm taking it as personal triumph that we've mentioned the term vas deferen twice already in this conversation on an unrelated subject.
But in any case...
But you have an illustration of it in the book. It does look like a scrotum. I understand why these people believed it was a giant scrotum. Well, exactly. I'm no paleontologist, but that would have been convincing to me.
I think Nopcsa would have had a good, better look. But he named it. This was the thing. He was writing about the time that Carl Linnaeus was systematising nature. And he called it the scrotum humanum. And it's a valid scientific name. So the very first dinosaur is the scrotum humanum. Therefore, dinosaurs should be the scrotalia. But by the 19th century, when Sir Richard Owen was naming dinosaurs, this was all not de rigueur. He wasn't interested in all that sort of stuff. So he just shoved it aside. But the rules of taxonomy don't let you do that. So
the original name is really the accurate name?
It was debated, because some people want to get rid of it and say it's superannuated and hasn't been used. But two of my friends who work at the British Museum, Peter Cox and Barry Cox and Peter Ball...
You're making that up.
No, I'm not making
Cox
it up.
And Ball.
Yeah, Cox and Ball. Sorry. No, I didn't say that. They put forward a case, argue that the scrotum humanum is actually valid and we need to rename the dinosaurs as Scrotalia. But
it's only 9 a.m.
The debate rumbles on, that's all I'll say.
So how did the term dinosaur come into use?
Well, that is the name created by a man called Sir Richard Owen, who was one of the most evil and horrible of people, I think, that ever graced paleontology. He stole, well, he didn't steal, he acquired material from a doctor, a country doctor called Hilary Mantel, who had collected the very first dinosaur bones. Mantel described some of them. Owen was a very jealous man and petty, and he Mantel went broke. He purchased Mantel's specimens. Mantel then had a carriage accident which twisted his back, and he lived in pain, extreme pain, for a number of years as Owen wrote up his material. When Mantel died, Owen dissected out his backbone and put it in his collection. So he collected the backbone of his rival. It was a really, really nasty piece of work. So unfortunately, his Dinosauria survived, whereas poor old Robert Plott's Scrotalia has failed. But anyway.
What happened around 66 million years ago to disturb the European dinosaur paradise?
Well, 66 million years ago was the moment when dinosaurs become extinct worldwide. And Europe was fairly close to the impact site, which was in Yucatan in what is now Mexico. And so North America was totally devastated. Europe was completely blitzed as well. And, we don't have a good fossil record for that time in Europe on land.
Why is that?
It's just a freak of the fossil record. We don't have every period represented. Sometimes there are what we call lacunae or absences, ghastly blanks, if you want, in the record. So we know the dinosaurs, they get right up towards that 66 million year point, then there's a blank, and then 60 million years ago the record takes up again.
So what happened? What was this event?
Well, it was a gigantic asteroid that smashed into the Earth, created a nuclear winter, fires, all sorts of, poisoned the atmosphere, poisoned the waters, and devastated life. Basically, anything that weighed more than 30-odd kilograms became extinct.
So what would have been around? What kind of animals and plants, creatures would have been on the Earth in the wake of that event?
Oh, well, it's, to me, when I look at the record of Europe 60 million years ago, what it brings to mind is those pictures of Europe just after the Second World War, devastated cities and, you know, blighted people crawling out of cellars and things. It was a bit like that. So you can imagine that this was such a severe event that even anything that lived in the trees was killed. So seeds survived, so the trees then regrew, but there was no leaf-eating insects, very few pollinators, nothing else eating leaves, so the forests grew enormous. There was nothing much on the ground. The species that survived locally in Europe were mostly subterranean, so burrowing snakes, some blind lizards, very small mammals that would have lived in burrows, the midwife toad, a great survivor.
So it was around then, before the asteroid hit, and it's still in Europe.
It is. It's Europe's most ancient organism. It and the salamanders and newts, they're Europe's natural nobility.
I don't think I've ever seen a midwife toad. What does it look like?
It's a little toad about that big. The thing that's unusual about it is that the males take care of the eggs, of the young. So it's a kind of a toad for our times, really. It's a very interesting creature. But it is. It's Europe's equivalent of the platypus. It's the ancient lineage of Europe.
What was going on in the oceans after the asteroid hit and there are the tsunamis and the fires? What was happening to life in the ocean?
Well, yeah, exactly. Can you imagine tsunamis a kilometre and a half high, battering the land, the ocean being poisoned so that the, most life that lives on the plankton all died. The oceans were basically poisoned and very few creatures survived. On land it was a little bit different. The freshwater systems were the ones that survived best. So, and the reason for that is that, you know, the rivers and lakes were fed by rotting vegetation for a number of years. So there's no photosynthesis, no new plant growing, but a lot of old plant matter rotting and bacteria eating that. So turtles and some fish and crocodiles could survive through that.
Could life on Earth have ended in the wake of that?
Well, if the asteroid had been much bigger, it would have been, really serious. Perhaps bacterial life would have survived, but it reset the clock for all of the bigger things.
And it's possible that another asteroid that size could hit at any point?
It is certain that another asteroid will hit at some point in the future. I mean, these things are statistically, you know, they happen every now and again.
Do we have any window as to what that point might be?
No.
Do I get another coffee or do I just wait?
I think we don't worry about it. Crossing the road's more dangerous really over a human lifetime. But
why have some of the creatures from this very ancient time in Europe's history ended up in our neighbourhood, ended up in Australia?
Well, this is one of the great discoveries of the book for me, was that ancient Europeans survive in Australia. So if I was a European and wanted to time travel, I'd come to Australia, you know. One of the most amazing discoveries is that, you know, the pig-nosed tortoise, has anyone heard of this creature? It lives in northern Australia and New Guinea. It's really, it's in its own family. It's this weird soft-shelled tortoise, freshwater thing about that big. There've been lots of fossils have been found in Europe, including at this a site called Messel in Germany, which is this, it's called a Lagerstätte, and it's a site where things are preserved in great detail. So there's fossil beetles, which are nearly 50 million years old, with their colours still on them. There are bodies of ancient horses with the fetuses still in the womb and the last meal in the stomach preserved. And 18 copulating pairs of pig-nosed tortoises. The only instance in the fossil record.
Wait. They were fossilised at the moment of copulation.
Yes, it's kind of
18 of them.
They kind of got together and were copulating in the water and then sunk into the areas where there were no oxygen and kind of just drifted off, were fossilised in flagranto delicto, so to speak. But it is remarkable. The fossil record's got a lot of surprises in it. You'd be interested.
I wonder if I should be fact-checking some of the things you're telling us this morning, Tim. It seems quite remarkable. But so this species end up over here.
Here it is in Australia. It survived extinct in Europe for 20 million years, surviving in Australia.
What about the link between our corals and England's New Forest? What's the connection there?
Again, that was one of the great discoveries for me. I thought coral reefs must have originated in Australia or the South Pacific. Wrong. They originate in Europe, and some of the oldest evidence we have is in southern England, in the New Forest. Can you imagine that as the bastion coral reef covered area that, you know, the Atlantic great breakers rolling up towards Europe and coral reefs forming there in this very active environment? It's remarkable.
Would
but that's
the life of those reefs resembled what we see on the Great Barrier Reef?
Absolutely. There's a fabulous fossil site. Again, if any of you go to Italy, forget the Uffizi. Go to Montebolca, because Montebolca has one of the most marvellous museums on the planet. It's the fossil fish of Montebolca. And these are the earliest record we have of coral reef-dwelling fish. So the angelfish and these sort of things, they're there. You know, there's a few groups absent, but basically it's a coral reef fauna.
You cover around 100 million years in this deep dive into the geology of Europe. What is it about the Miocene epoch, Tim, that is so enchanting to you? Of all the epochs, why the Miocene?
Well, the Miocene just sees this wonderful flowering of European life. So, you know, if we want to see life on land at its most vigorous today, you probably go to the Masai Mara in Africa and see the great fauna that exists there. Well, Europe was a bit like that in the Miocene.
So which is what time period?
It's about 23 to 5 million years ago. 23 million to 5 million years ago. So, you know, back then Europe would have had maybe 15 species of rhinos. Can you imagine that? How great is that? You know, there was the first elephants were there.
Rhinos that look like the rhinos that exist in Africa today?
Well, some looked like that, but others were bizarre. They had two horns on the side of their snout rather than one in the middle. You know, there's some really interesting things.
Well, one of the creatures that was around at that time, Chalicotheres. How's my pronunciation?
Chalicotherium.
Chalicotherium.
Yeah.
What was a Chalicotherium?
Ah, now there is a great question, because as a paleontologist, I can admit that our profession was confused by its fossils for decades. You know, people would classify the head in one order of mammals and the feet in another, right? It's kind of bizarre. But you've got to imagine an animal probably the size of a horse, with a head like a horse, so not much difference in head shape, a long neck like a kind of a short-necked giraffe type of a thing, and then a body a bit like a gorilla with claws like a giant sloth. It's kind of so weird. No one knows what to do with this thing or what are they. But if there was one animal I could bring back from oblivion, it would be the Chalicothea. I'd love to see it.
Do you have any idea if it had fur or feathers, or what was its skin like?
Well, it would have had fur because it was a mammal. Long or short, we don't know. Look, it really is still a mystery. It's one of those...
How did paleontologists realise that all these disparate parts belonged to the one creature?
Well, finally, someone found a skeleton. This is the thing you have to... You know, sometimes you just got to wait for good luck in paleontology.
Is DNA analysis useful when we're talking about things this old?
Not for the Miocene, but for more recent material, yes. In fact, the study of ancient DNA is one of those areas of science that's just going ahead by leaps and bounds at the moment. And we're now able to purify DNA from fossils as much as 100,000 or 200,000 years old. And that is really interesting.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Sarah Konofsky. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
At this period where there are rhinos and elephants in Europe, were they evolved from the same ancestors as the ones that are in Africa?
Look, it's very varied. So in the case of the rhinos, Europe's rhinos are more related to the Asian rhinoceros species than the African ones today. For the elephants, they've always come out of Africa. So Africa is the home of elephants, and we thought until recently the home of the upright apes like ourselves, but that has recently been proved incorrect.
Why? What's been discovered about upright apes?
If you go back 7 million years, that's when us upright apes and chimpanzees had a common ancestor, 7 or 8 million years. People have discovered, in Greece of all places, the very earliest evidence of upright apes recently, even footprints, which is extraordinary. There they are, 7 million years or 6 million years old, footprints of upright apes. So it now looks as if upright apes evolved in Europe and then travelled into Africa, went extinct in Europe, evolved in Africa into something like us, and then our distant ancestors, Homo erectus, back migrated again into Europe. So it's a much more complicated story than we first realised.
Why are creatures doing so much travelling around the globe? This I never understood. Why are they just staying in their own patch? Why are they wandering from continent to continent?
That's a great question, but look, we see it in paleontology so often. If an opportunity presents itself, if a land bridge opens up, nature swarms in and fills the gap. Any opportunity to colonise new land is taken up, and this is why Europe is this crossroads is just so central. So we've had species from Asia swarming in the more distant past, species from North America coming in, species from Africa. And every time this happens, we get hybridization if there's near relatives occurring.
When do Neanderthals come on the scene in Europe?
The current orthodoxy is that the Neanderthals come out of Africa about 800,000 years ago, and or their ancestors. They move into Europe. Over several hundred thousand years, they adapt to European conditions and become these typical Neanderthals. So by about 400,000 years ago, we've got typical Neanderthals.
Well, what's a typical... I mean, I've got a cartoon image of what a Neanderthal looks like. Is that accurate?
No, it's not. They look, Neanderthals were... they were heavy-set people, so immensely muscular, and they were hunters. They were top-order predators. So if you're going to take on a rhinoceros or an elephant, you need to be muscular. And these and they had a lot of bone breakage in among their skeletons. We see they were leading a robust life. Ancient DNA suggests that they had white skin, and you need pale skin in the north because otherwise your children suffer from rickets. You don't get enough vitamin D. They had very large eyes, which relative to ours, because they were living in caves and in dark conditions and they needed great visual acuity. So large eyes, blue eyes, beautiful large blue eyes, red hair, very big brain on average larger than ours.
This is very different from the cartoon image of a Neanderthal.
And exquisitely good at manufacturing. So in the early European record, we've found javelins 300,000 years old, which were used to hunt horses, which perform as well as the best Olympic javelins that can be made today. And these are made out of timber.
How have they been preserved?
In a bog, along with the skeletons of horses. They made glue, a very sophisticated glue, to fasten stones to their arrows and so forth, stone heads. They made houses, were found in caves, of stalactite fragments. They didn't make much art. We haven't got very little in the way of art. We have a few indications that they may have used feathers as decoration. And they used teeth of carnivores as to make necklaces. But the big, that's all early Neanderthal. So 200,000 years ago, there was a vibrant culture. By 50,000 years ago, that culture had dwindled. And the reason for that, we think, is that they lived in very tiny groups. And as the Ice Age increased its grip, those small populations became disjunct. We've got lots of evidence for inbreeding among those Neanderthals and the loss of cultural material. And that probably happened because, you know, in a small group, there may be one woman who knows how to make a jewellery out of bird feathers or whatever. If she dies without passing that on, then that's lost to the culture.
Because I guess it's that shift from just instinctual behaviour to learned cultural behaviour with this species then.
Well, they were learning, but certainly they were like us in so many ways.
Did they have language? Is there any way that we can know that?
That's a great question. We don't know, although my gut feeling is they probably had language. They were a different species, but very similar to ourselves in so many ways. And in fact, we know that they could hybridise with us because we are the result.
Well, tell us about that. When does our species, Homo sapiens, come on the scene in Europe?
Extraordinarily late. So in Australia here, the Aboriginal ancestors, the Aborigines, arrived between 60 and 45,000 years ago. The first truly modern people don't get into Europe till 14,000 years ago. But there's a really interesting backstory to that, so I've got to just go back a bit. I said first truly modern people, right? People started migrating out of Africa and into Europe about 38,000 years ago, and we know what those people were like. They were Africans, black-skinned or dark-skinned Africans, just the same as the people you'd see today in Africa. They get up into Romania, and Romania is the opening of what's called the Danubian Corridor, and almost every species that's migrated into Europe over the last few million years has used the Danubian Corridor. There's a pinch point in that corridor called the Iron Gates on Danube River, and there are caves in that area. And in those caves, people have found the remains of hominids, beings a bit like us.
So what's a hominid?
It's an upright ape, a bit like us. You know, But what these remains show is that they're neither modern humans nor Neanderthals. They're hybrids. And we can tell from the lengths of DNA in those remains that these are fourth generation or fifth generation hybrids. So these are beings whose great-grandmother was a Neanderthal and whose great-grandfather was an African person. And so this is 38,000 years ago. The first of these beings comes into existence, and almost instantaneously they spread throughout Europe. They're a stable hybrid, so they spread and they displace.
And they can reproduce.
Reproduce and reliably, and they spread through Europe and displace the Neanderthals. And also don't allow any of the full-blooded modern Africans to get in. They become the Europeans. And, you know, the second they arrive, we see this enormous flowering of culture. So the cave paintings of Chauvet and Altamira, these priceless treasures from the Ice Age, they are the fruits of the labour of these hybrid people. The very first musical instruments ever made were made by these hybrid people. We've found them in caves in Germany.
It's incredible, Tim. How long has this been known by paleontologists?
No one has put it all together until I wrote this book. Because the bits have been there, but no one's understood what happened. Hybrids are extraordinary. They have characteristics which can sometimes are not evident in either parent species.
So when I think of those the extraordinary art of what I assumed as early Homo sapien ancestors, that actually is a hybrid.
Yeah, it's
species.
Not early Homo sapien ancestors. That is the work of the hybrid organisms that took over Europe. They no longer exist, and I'll come to that in a minute. But among their other great achievements was the first domestication of animals. So Domestication of dogs appears to have occurred in Europe around about 38,000 years ago.
What's the record for that?
We have some skulls from Belgium, dog skulls, and also in Chauvet Cave there is a series of footprints. It's marvellous, you know, footprints of a child and a large wolf-like dog walking side by side through this gallery of cave art, which even then was ancient. You know, so you can imagine a Huckleberry Finn type character and his dog sneaking into the cave and having a look. And this was just before the cave was sealed off by a rock fall. But in any case, what was it about those hybrids that did this? There's one artifact which I've looked at again and again and again for insights. It's a thing called the Lion Man of Hohlfels, which is a cave in southern Germany. It's made from a mammoth tusk. It's about that high. It was found in thousands of fragments, but it's been put together, and it's a human body, so it's standing upright, with a lion head on it. It's a hybrid human-lion sculpture made by a hybrid people. And it was the only thing found in that cave. It was clearly a sacred object. And I wonder whether people told the story of their origins, their hybrid origins, with this lion figure. Maybe the ancestral knowledge of where they'd come from, because it's about the same age as the hybrid, was embodied in this fabulous artifact.
Incredible. What allowed these hybrids to flourish in Europe? What advantage did they have over the Neanderthals, all the other Homo sapiens trying to get in at the front door?
Well, this is the great question. I mean, any farmer is will be familiar with the idea of hybrid vigour, that sometimes when you hybridise forms, you get these very vigorous forms. I don't know exactly what it was about those hybrids, because they're now vanished, that gave them this figure. But you can imagine a bit. One thing they would have had is the white skin and the blue eyes and the red hair to some extent. They would have been very mixed, but there'd be clearly some strong selection for keeping the white skin.
Which is advantageous in a cold landscape.
Yeah, because you don't get enough vitamin D, you know. The large blue eyes, as well, you can imagine being, you know, selected for. So the Neanderthal genes that did that sort of thing stayed with those people. But it's the domestication that interests me, you know, because to domesticate a dog, the way it would have happened almost certainly is that, you know, a hunter goes out, finds a lair, takes the puppies, brings them back to camp. Normally they'd be turned into dinner, but for some reason 38,000 years ago in Europe, presumably a young girl or a woman took the puppy and decided to socialise it and to make it a member of her group, bring it up as a plaything or a child. The mind that did that is what fascinates me. Why did no Neanderthal, in all the history of Neanderthals, ever do that? Why did no human, Homo sapiens in Africa or anywhere else in Europe or Asia, in all the history of people, ever do that? Why was it that only these hybrid people did that? What was going on in their mind? And that's one of the great mysteries and intriguing things that I'm desperate to learn more about.
Do we still have genetic trace of Neanderthals in our DNA today?
We do. Well, you know, those people, those hybrids, they survived as a stable hybrid population between 38,000 years ago and 14,000 years ago in Europe. And if taxonomists or scientists had come along then, they probably would have classified them as a different species, right, because they're a stable hybrid. But beginning 14,000 years ago, new waves of human immigrants from Asia started moving into Europe, and these were people who had control of fire in particular ways, I think, the people who built some of the early temples in Turkey, and followed closely by the early agriculturalists, the people who had the sheep and cattle and all this sort of stuff. They come in and they swamp those earlier populations, so some genes survive. You know, the hybrids had probably 10%, 8 to 10% Neanderthal genes. We have 2%. So
And is that in European populations, that 2% of Neanderthal DNA?
Probably 2% of you or me is Neanderthal, right, still. And between, you'll have different Neanderthal genes to me.
One of the shorter Neanderthals.
Yeah that's right. Well, yeah, exactly. But you know, what we do know is that between all of us, we will have most of the Neanderthal genome preserved in our bodies.
So one of the remarkable things that is happening in this time is the domestication of animals. What other kind of relationships besides dogs, what other kind of animals were humans interacting in this period?
Well, the earliest sheep, goats, cattle, all seem to have been domesticated, and pigs around about the same time. And they're domesticated by people from Western Asia who are very sophisticated boat builders. So by 10,500 years ago, they're building boats that are good enough to get to the Mediterranean islands, like Cyprus and so forth, along with their flocks. And so they bring these flocks in with them and colonise the Mediterranean basin and go as far, in fact, as the Shetland Islands. You know, they push through Europe, either hybridising with or displacing these earlier hunter-gatherer populations.
And what would have been the biggest animals that they were encountering once they weren't able to domesticate?
Well, by 10,000 years ago, the European megafauna is pretty much gone. You know, there would have been elephants on some of the Mediterranean islands. They survived till 6,000 years ago. The woolly mammoth had gone by 14,000 years ago. The giant elk, which is, you know, the Irish elk, that survived on the Isle of Man until 9,000 odd years ago, but that was a bit of an exception.
And the rhinos and elephants, why did they disappear from Europe?
Well, that's the great question. But they survive until the hybrids arrive, and then one by one they slowly wink out. And I think that hybrid population were just absolutely expert hunters. And, you know, the Neanderthals had put the large mammals under some pressure but hadn't been able to exterminate them, extinguish them. The humans seem to have just worked through one after the other. And, you know, the lions of Europe are a bit of a tragic story. You know, there was a thing called the cave lion, very much like a modern lion, but probably had some hybrid genes in it, but it was spread throughout Europe. The very last of the cave lions were found fossils in Spain in a cave of the claws off a skin. So it's someone's hut in a cave. The skin's rotted away, but just the claws of the forepaws being preserved with the cut marks to show where the animal was skinned. And that was about 14,000 years ago. That was the last lion we know of in Europe, last cave lion. So people settle, but then the African lions come back. They push back against this great human tide. So 10,000 years ago, African lions say, we can take on these humans. We're going to give it a go. They push through into Europe. They get as far as Spain, and they last for 5,000 years. Amazing. And, you know, and Herodotus saw lions in Macedonia 2,000 odd years ago, 2,500 years ago. You know, there was lions in Georgia until 1,000 years ago, and in eastern Turkey until about 1700 or 1800. So we think about Europe's megafauna as having vanished a long time ago, but in fact, some species like lions were there till recently.
As you've been saying, when we think of ancient Europe, we need to think of islands, really. Tell me about Dorothea Bate and the role she played in unearthing the paleontology of the Mediterranean islands.
Well, she's another one of my heroes, probably alongside Nopska. You know, she was a wonderful, lively woman who worked at the British Museum as what's called a piece worker. So, you know, most of the men in the British Museum would have got a full-time job, you know. She was paid for every piece of work she did. So it'd say, stuff that monkey, and she'd do that and she'd be paid for that, or, you know, that bird and whatever. So she never had security of tenure, but she was very, very bright. And she happened to meet a paleontologist, a man who suggested that she goes to the Mediterranean islands to look for fossils there. So she funds her own expedition to go. She says of herself, by the way, that, you know, someone asked her about her education, and she said, oh, it was only briefly interrupted by school.
What period is this? Is she 1920s?
Yeah, 1920s, thereabouts. So no one had been out to the Mediterranean islands to look for fossils. So she goes to Cyprus and tracks down these stories of the bones of the seven sleepers or the seven saints that are found in caves on these islands. And these are caves with fossil bones in them that the local people would go to and take a piece of bone if they were sick and grind it up and drink it as a kind of a holy kind of cure for their disease. But she finds that these bones are in fact the bones of an extinct hippopotamus, which was found only on Cyprus. And she just goes through one island after the other on her own money, doing it right, finding giant dormice, pygmy hippopotamuses, strange goats with heads like monkeys, kind of one thing after the other, these wonderful fauna that vanished sometimes only a few thousand years ago on these European islands.
And as a female paleontologist, what kind of extra obstacles did Dorothea face while she was fossil hunting?
Well, she was propositioned by, rather crudely, as I take it, from and a number of men in various positions of authority, and she writes about this in her notebook. But somehow she just pushed through it all, and without money, without the credibility of being a professor and so forth, she makes this marvellous lifelong contribution. And you know, even in the 1950s and 60s, when she's quite aged, she goes to Jerusalem to do something and finds the bones of a giant tortoise and digs that up. I mean, you know, in Jerusalem of all places. So she's this tremendous kind of lively character.
You mentioned in these moments of extinction across the whole vast history of Europe, does it follow a kind of even rhythm? Or when we look back over this time period, are there moments where there's little extinction and then moments when there's vast amounts of extinction?
Yeah, look, it's very pulsed. So the extinction events of the last, say, 50,000 years in Europe are where you see it gather pace. So, you know, as I mentioned, 50,000 years ago, there was probably about 70,000 Neanderthals living in Europe and no modern humans. That's a tiny population, you know. Once the hybrids come in, population density increases, but there's probably still only less than 1 million people. But, you know, then by Roman times, you know, agricultural times, it's tens of millions, you know. By the 1940s, it's hundreds of millions, you know. And, you know, by that stage, every square centimetre of Europe that could be used for something is being used. And the megafauna is a distant memory. I mean, even the ibex is becoming extinct. And, you know, when I think about that, and you look today at Africa and see the challenge that we have there in preserving biodiversity. I mean, the challenges in Europe 70 years ago were so much more severe, and yet we somehow triumphed.
What's the idea of rewilding in Europe? How does that fit into this story?
Well, you know, to me, the Europeans are always inventing something new. They're ahead of the curve by virtue of this great influx of ideas and migration that occurs from everywhere and creates this marvellous new thing in Europe. And the latest new thing is the European Union, you know, marvellous, a novel form of politics. Fascinating. But they've also gone further than that in nature and are now talking about rewilding, which is trying to breathe life back into natural Europe. So you can go to a place called, Oostvaardersplassen in the Netherlands, where 60 kilometres of land have been put back to nature.
And what's it like when you go there?
Oh, it's stunning. It's gorgeous. You go into this area. It's only been recovered from the sea in the 1970s, so it was under the water before that. But you walk onto this plain and the soil is so rich, you know, and so fertilised with dung, you know, you smell the life in the soil. And you see 60,000 barnacle geese, you know, off in the distance. And there's, you know, great herds of these tarpan-like horses, you know, and the things that look like aurochs. These are cattle that resemble the ancient ancestor of the cattle, a wild ancestor called the aurochs, and deer, herds of deer. And it feels to me like stepping back into the Ice Age. It's a wonderful thing.
How are they going about introducing those animals? I mean, how are they choosing what to bring in? Because one of the things that you point out is there's been such variety of animals in Europe over its history. Should we bring back hippos or lions or wild horses? What do we choose?
I might be bringing back hippos and elephants and everything else, but Franz Vera, who runs the project, has been more modest in his ambitions, probably wisely so, and it's he that has put together the species that he thinks will form a stable community. And it's really an experiment, you know. But elsewhere in Europe, other species are being introduced. So the wisent, for example.
What's a wisent?
A wisent is a great buffalo-like creature, another stable hybrid. It's a hybrid between the plains bison of North America and the ancient aurochs of Europe. And it first arose about 160,000 years ago, just like the hybrid human population we talked about. But it has persisted as a stable hybrid into modern times. It's Europe's largest wild animal. The bulls can weigh a ton. You know, they're huge. So they're being put back into the Carpathians as we speak. 3 weeks ago, I was in Knepp, in the English Weald, in Sussex, standing in a 3,500-acre area of rewilded land at Knepp Estate, and I saw something I hadn't seen since I was a child. Vast numbers of insects. You know, do you remember driving along the roads and insects splattering on things? Haven't seen it recently. The only place I've seen it recently is Knepp. And there, that was a clapped-out dairy farm 2 decades ago. Now, due to rewilding, It's this great centre of biodiversity where all of the birds and insects that are vanishing elsewhere in Europe are coming back. And the farmer who owns that land is making an honest living. He's not living off European subsidies or destroying the soil. He's selling the meat of his Dartmoor ponies, of his deer and his pigs into the market. And there's a market that wants that clean meat, you know, and that sustainably produced meat. At the same time, he looks after this amazing estate. But to see it, it's incredible because it's this great bramble patch. You know, there's a few ancient oaks and big trees springing back, but a lot of it is the low, thorny scrub that maybe Tacitus described 2,000 years ago as the Silvum Horridum, you know, of Europe.
Let's look forward instead of back, Tim. If you were to travel forward in Europe, say, 180 years, what might you imagine things look like?
Well, you know, that's the great question. And a fellow who worked with me on the book, a man called Luigi Boitani, owns some land in the most depopulated part of Italy, near Siena in Tuscany. And he planted an oak tree about 15 years ago. And I asked him, I said, Luigi, what do you think this oak tree will be like in 200 years' time? He said, I know what the oak tree will be like, but I have no idea what Europe will be like. And we started thinking about it. And there's some trends you can see already happening. Europe is abandoning land at a massive rate. So over the next decade, 20 million hectares of European farmland will be abandoned. So what does that mean? You know, that's why rewilding is so important. Do we just leave that to the accident of nature the moment we stepped away from it? Or do we try to use landscape architects, the large fauna? I think that Europeans will create something new. I think that their means of food production will start to become very compact. There won't be as need for as much farmland. So I think in future Europe is going to be this archipelago of cities, closely surrounded by their food production systems, and there'll be a great wild forest, hopefully full of elephants and rhinos and other things, separating these cities. And I think that the young Europeans, they're an adventurous people. They will be going out into this new wilderness to experience excitement and to learn and to record things. And perhaps tourists from Asia or Africa will be coming to Europe to see the vanished megafauna that their parents drove into extinction. You know, 80 years from now, Africa will have 4 billion people. Where will there be room for lions and for elephants? My answer is Europe.
Please join me in thanking Tim Flannery.
That conversation with scientist Tim Flannery was recorded at the Byron Writers Festival in 2019. Tim's book is called Europe, A Natural History. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks so much for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hey, you're clearly someone who loves quality conversations and big ideas, right? I like your style. I'm Jan Fran, and I'm here to recommend another podcast I think you'll love. Mine. The Pineapple Project is a life improvement podcast, and we have a new season all about connection.
One of the most important things you can do now is to invest in your relationships.
They made a gesture to me that was just so helpful. It blew me away.
Other people are scary. Why would you make friends with other people on your street?
You are not a solo performer. You're a member of a choir.
Throughout the series, I uncover a key finding from the world's largest and longest study on happiness, discover a crucial relationship that a lot of us neglect, and find the one terrible mistake that we are all making with our phones, and how to fix it. It's pretty life-changing, and it'll improve your own conversations in your own life. I promise. Come on over to the Pineapple Project in the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.